Tom Woods Show, episode 2322.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, our old friend Gene Epstein, the man with a resume as long as his arm, who is currently the director of the Soho Forum, the outstanding libertarian debate series in Manhattan, is with us, and I am thrilled to be able to talk to him again. As you know, if you are a veteran of the Tom Woods Show, that means there's going to be a few minutes of opening banter between us. It can't be avoided, and you can always fast forward, or as Gene says, you can listen to the opening banter and then just forget the rest of the episode, however you like. But Gene, I'm glad to have you back, and let's hold off for a second on the exact reason you're here.
Oh, sure.
And let's instead talk about what we want to tell people about in terms of your activities.
Well, yes. Thank you, Tom. And again, thank you especially for mentioning the Soho Forum. If you recall, Tom, it was about a week and a half ago now that my wife, Asako, and I had lunch with you and your wife, Jenna. And I mentioned the next debate at the Soho Forum, which will be on Monday, May 22nd. This takes place in downtown Manhattan. And this will be a Northwestern University professor of law, Andrew Koppelman, defending the resolution, libertarianism has been thoroughly corrupted by delusion, greed, and disdain for the weak. I got interested in this because he's written a book called Burning Down the House, How Libertarian Philosophy Was Corrupted by Delusion and Greed. And in fact, David Gordon at the Mises Institute has written a couple of reviews of that book. But I mentioned my lunch with you, Tom, because when I gave you that resolution, Tom immediately launched into the outlines of a rebuttal, all of which, of course, were actually pretty much parallel with the kind of rebuttal I would use.
So this rebuttal is taking place, everybody, over lunch. Just make sure you understand. This was in person about a week and a half ago or something like that.
That's right, but it was a spontaneously brilliant moment for Tom Woods. And
again, you know, we got to record some of these lunches. They could be bonus episodes or something.
Yes, indeed. But the point is that it gave me the usual twinge of regret that Tom has done as Bobby Fischer and retired from the debating field, because I think he could do a better job negating this resolution than I could. And that gets to me. I will be taking the negative on that resolution. Again, Andrew Koppelman will be taking the affirmative. Libertarianism has been thoroughly corrupted by delusion, greed, and disdain for the weak. And just to give a preview, I would say, of course, that libertarians are important whistleblowers on the degree to which those in power are corrupted by delusion, greed, and disdain for the weak. That will be my line of argument, and that indeed was Tom's brilliant, brief line of argument when we had lunch. And so an open invitation to Tom was to step in for me if he so chooses, because I think he'd do a better job than I would. But it's going to be me, and that'll be Monday, May 22nd. I hope you can come. And again, I suggest make it a long weekend and see the play that goes wrong at New World Stages, which Tom has seen many times, his favorite play, and it still will be playing at New World Stages. Again, May 22nd, Monday, come in that for that previous weekend. Plenty of time to prepare your trip. I hope to see you there. So thanks for allowing me that little plug, Tom. And again, there's an open invitation for you to come, but I guess you'll, of course, be busy with your five daughters, and that I completely respect. But also, I want to mention that in June, we'll be taking a show on the road, as we have, but this will be the third June in a row that we will be at the Porcupine Festival. And of course, you know why they call themselves porcupines, because libertarians are supposed to be like porcupines, we fight back only if you try hurting us. That apparently is in the nature of porcupines. We're going to be doing two soul form debates at Porkfest. Porkfest is going to be June 19th to the 25th in Lancaster, New Hampshire. If you come in from out of town, from way out of town, I mean, then you fly to Logan Airport in Boston, the Boston Airport, and then I guess it's about an 80-minute drive from Logan to Lancaster, New Hampshire, and there are plenty of hotels and a fair amount of opportunity to camp out there. You've been there, what, at least once, Tom, or twice? Try to remember.
I think I've been there twice.
Twice. Well, I guess Tom isn't going to be there this time, but this time I will be debating David Friedman, the illustrious and widely published son of Milton Friedman, who will be defending the resolution, the right way to persuade people of libertarianism is by showing them that its outcomes are superior without any resort to the flawed non-aggression principle. Taking the negative will be me. Again, David is going to take essentially a completely consequentialist view of libertarianism because he believes that the non-aggression principle is actually not just flawed, but almost a total self-contradictory non-starter. Rather extreme view on David's part, which I'm going to attempt to rebut. And that will be on Friday, June 23rd at Porkfest in the main pavilion at 12 noon. Then the day before, Thursday, June 22nd, Jeremy Kaufman, who is a big fixture in the Free State of New Hampshire, as many of you know, Porkfest is held in part as an advertisement for the Free State, the movement that's trying to take over the state of New Hampshire by those porcupines, those libertarians. Jeremy Kaufman is a main player in the Free State, and he will be defending the resolution. It is easier to convert a heterosexual to homosexuality than to convert a non-libertarian to libertarianism. And that's basically the view of the Free State people. They believe that libertarianism is kind of a minority view and that the best strategy for libertarians is to congregate in one state like New Hampshire and live happily ever after because we're unlikely to convert the rest of the world to libertarianism. Well, negating that resolution will be the famous and great Matt Kibbe, whom I jokingly call a great libertarian kibitzer, a great guy, and he's going to be taking the negative on that resolution. So that's reason enough for you to come to Porkfest for two soul form debates. On top of that, on Saturday morning at Porkfest, June 24th, I'll be doing an economics workshop on the use and abuse of economic data. Well, thanks very much for allowing me to make those announcements, Tom. I have no further preliminaries and no real banter to offer you this morning. But those events, I think, are pretty important, and I'm glad that you allowed me to announce them before we get to the main event.
Well, I'll say that because we do have stuff to talk about and we have spent more monetary, there's nobody teaching you how to be an effective podcaster who will say, wait 9 minutes before you get into the real material. That is not recommended. But when you get to be at my status where you've done over 2,300 episodes, just throw the rules right out the window. But I would talk to you about the whirlwind trip I took last weekend. I was actually in the city last weekend again one of my daughters, but I'm not going to tell that story right now. We'll talk about that some other time. Let's get to one aspect of our lunch conversation that has spawned this episode.
Okay, fine.
So
even Tom takes the liberty of tantalizing us with a story that he's not going to tell us.
What? Not going to tell. That's right. If you're on my business email list, you actually got an email about my trip and a video clip of my daughter and me in a pedicab going from the theater to the hotel. Anyway,
I got
to
read.
Here's the thing. Some time ago, Gene sent me an email saying, Tom, I think you said something that's just demonstrably wrong on your episode. And I'm going to explain to you why it is. And I said, Gene, I think you're a great guy, but I think this is just nitpicking because what I actually meant was blah, blah, blah. And you were very frustrated. Well, okay, fine. Whatever. Okay, fine. But then I thought, okay, well, that's over. Then we went to lunch. It is not over. Gene brings it up at lunch and says, Tom, I really need to revisit this thing because I really think you were wrong in what you said on your episode. And so then I put up a feeble defense of myself. And then finally, yes, dear listener, I conceded the point to Gene. Now, I'm not infallible. And sometimes I will say things that are careless or even outright wrong. And I'll admit to them.
That's right. And Tom does not want to be confused with Tony Fauci. You know, when you criticize me, you criticize science, as Fauci said. And Tom does not want it clear that when you criticize Tom, you're criticizing libertarian knowledge. No.
Oh, you're criticizing economics, Gene. I am economics. Trust the economics, Gene.
Trust the economics and trust Tom. And indeed, we are all fallible, including Tom. And so I want to actually focus on the email exchange we had, because Tom told me, again, and I'm nitpicking, Tom originally had a great way to characterize what he thinks of as many of my criticisms. He said that he told me that I'm often telling him that you forgot to put the umlaut over that particular letter. He accused me of being an umlauter, and I rolled with that punch.
Look, we have to tell them what it is I'm wrong about at this point. How many minutes have to go by before we finally tell them?
Well, okay, yeah. Yeah, no, so Tom originally wrote twice that the boom-bust cycles make saving for retirement borderline impossible.
Okay, but back up. Not the boom-bust cycle per se, the fiat money system.
The fiat, well, fair enough, yes. All right, the fiat money system, which of course is at the root of the boom-bust cycle, but makes saving for retirement borderline impossible. Okay, but then when I quoted that back to him and said, really, everything else you said about the fiat money system is true, but not really saving for retirement being borderline impossible, he wrote, I think it's nitpicking, I should have said much more challenging. That's not deniable. Okay. Now, much more challenging. I guess what I really should have written back, although I misinterpreted what he wrote a little bit, is just that it's really not that challenging, or at least I should speak in the past tense because of what I'm going to get to about the future and what this means for the future. In the past tense, from 1871 to the present, through March 2023, it really has not been very challenging at all to invest for retirement. And so that's really what I'm going to try to maintain, that it's not very challenging. Tom went on to write, what are average people doing in the stock market, regardless of what a good investment it is? Well, there I have...
Well, hold on. Let me just clarify why I said what I said.
Okay.
My point was that in the days of hard money, the money itself, the coins, the money itself either held or increased its value.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to go into the, quote, stock market, or you didn't have to figure out, where should I put my money? You could put your money under the mattress if you wanted
exactly.
to.
Yes,
that
yes.
was my point. Now, if you want to make a higher return, then sure, you can invest it in any number of things. But you always had this extremely conservative option available to you that you do not have today. Because if you put a bunch of dollar bills under the mattress, you know what's going to happen. In a generation, the value will be down by a third or more.
Well, that sparks me to mention a little habit of mine that comes from Ludwig von Mises's book, The Theory of Money and Credit. I've always thought that this digression, I think, will be worth it. I've always thought the idea that money is a store of value, it's a medium of exchange and a store of value. And all that Mises said is that everything you want to say about money derives from the fact that it's a medium of exchange. And then Mises went on to say that, yes, of course, if you put money in a mattress, then it will appreciate in value. He said, but in the modern world of stocks and bonds, people do not use money as a store of value. Oddly enough, Tom is saying that we're all going to be like the proverbial French peasant who keeps the money in a mattress. And Mises actually, back in 1912, when that book was published, he took it for granted that the vast majority of us will be using financial instruments to augment our holdings. Even then, that was not regarded as that much of a stretch by Mises. Similarly, what we have today is known as, and we've had for many, many years, are stock indexes. We have stock index funds. We have funds that are indexed to the stock market. And millions of people have taken advantage of those stock indexes. And indeed, they've been used as a benchmark I would even say, just to take another swipe at you, Tom, that when you had Mark Skousen on his show, you should have asked him, have you beaten the market? And that's a very, very cliche question at this point. And what that means when you say, have you beaten the market, is that you take a typical stock index. The most famous one today that's actually a legitimate stock index is the S&P 500. The S&P Standard & Poor's 500 is a capitalization-weighted stock index of the 500 biggest stocks. And they pretty much account for like 85% or more of all market value. And what does capitalization mean? It means that if stock A is priced at $100 and stock B is priced at $100, but if stock A has twice as many shares outstanding, then stock A has a capitalization of twice stock B. They both have the same price, but stock A has twice as many shares. So you take the price, you multiply it by the number of shares outstanding, and that's how the index is weighted. The bigger the stock, the greater the weight it gets in the index. That's a cap-weighted index, the Standard & Poor's 500. I should mention, since we're into that, that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, compiled many years ago before the computer age, is not a capitalization-weighted index and therefore has a little bit of a problem in terms of tracking the market. But the Standard & Poor's 500, which was developed in 1926, and in those days, they would update it only once a week because they needed to use calculators or abacuses to be able to update all 500 in terms of cap weighting. But now, of course, it's updated by the second by computers. So that's the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And then they brought out index funds. Why did they bring out index funds? Because there was an enormous market for index funds among many, many millions of people, ordinary people who, contrary to what Tom seems to imply, are not that clueless that they don't know how to invest in an index fund. The index fund has no real management fee. It's run by a computer because all it has to do is index the stocks to the computer-generated, mathematically generated S&P 500 index. And it became very popular because it was revealed decades ago by now, really, that the vast majority of actively managed funds do not beat the market. They charge you a higher fee and they don't do as well as, so to speak, the blind investment in the stock index, which simply tracks the cap-weighted stocks. So it's just reasonably clear so far, Tom, because you play an important role in making sure that I come across clearly in my explanations. How are we doing so far?
Yes, perfectly clear. Now, there are objections I can imagine people having, but I want to let you continue to flesh out your entire point. Only then will I raise objections.
Objections. Okay. I don't think anybody could object to the idea that
Not objecting to. Of course, nobody's going to object to the idea of stock indexes.
Well,
that maybe, you know, the argument that these particular circumstances may be so unusual,
yes,
that the reliability of stock investing over the past century might actually not prove anything. You know, so we'll get to that. But
yes,
I want you to be able to say everything you want to say.
Well, that's right. But I guess I'll fall back on the old cliche that a decent predictor of future performance is past performance, even though there's always often that disclaimer when you review a track record that past performance is no predictor of future performance. But we're talking about the record since 1871, and I guess that's going on 150 years, not just a century. By the way, in 1871 is when the records of stock prices began to become reliable, and it was actually Jeremy Siegel, a professor at Wharton, who originally delivered a talk at Freedom Fest, hosted by our friend, your friend and mine, Mark Skousen. I heard his talk years ago, and I had dinner with him. I wrote articles based upon Siegel's research because it went back to 1871 about the performance of the stock market. But I want to add that many stocks pay dividends, cash dividends. And the other thing you can do when you buy a stock index fund is tell the fund to reinvest all the dividends.
Right.
The dividends are paid quarterly. And so you reinvest quarterly dividends in your holdings. So that helps add to your returns. Now, then a number of decades ago, there were retirement accounts that were made legal by the government. I'll take the typical case, the 401k and the IRA. You can put tax-deductible money into a retirement account every year, and the money is reinvested tax-free until you take it out, which is mandated at age 70. In fact, if you continue to have a job as I did, I didn't have to take mine out until age 73 when I left my job. And so you can compile returns tax-free until you take them out, and then you take them out in pieces over the years, and you do pay taxes on them. So you can use 401k or an IRA as a tax-free way of reinvesting in a stock index fund with reinvested dividends. And so my only point is that retrospectively, Tom, this is not rocket science. This is not very difficult for the average person to think about. And specifically, let's say at age 30, you've got some kind of steady job with a company and you decide to start a 401k and the company takes money out of your paycheck every time you're paid and puts it in the stock index fund with reinvested dividends. Many companies actually give you some kind of matching funds. I actually got that when I was both at the New York Stock Exchange as well as when I was at News Corp working for Dow Jones. I got a match and matching funds. And so at the age of 30, you just do that with a stock index fund with reinvested dividends, and you don't look at it again until you're 70 when you're ready to retire. So that's a 40-year period. Then what is likely to happen? Well, what will happen, would have happened over that 40-year period is that your money would have appreciated in value. That what really would have happened is simply that in any 15-year period, any 15-year period based upon the data that I just ran from 1970 to the present, any 15-year period, your money would have compounded faster than the rate of inflation. The worst performance in any 15-year period would have been 1.8% ahead of inflation. The best performance over any 15-year period would have been 16%. And through March of 2023, ending in that 15-year period, you would have been 7.7% ahead of inflation. So retroactively, at least, you're talking about a huge augmentation of your money. When your money compounds at 7.7% ahead of inflation, 7% has a 10-year doubling time. So every 10 years, your money would double. And over the complete period from 1970 to the present, your money would have been about 6.6% ahead of inflation. So again, what have we really said? What we have said is that the stock market does indeed have ups and downs in any 5-year period or in any 10-year period. But if you're investing for the long run in terms of your retirement account, then you're going to stay ahead of inflation because in any 5 or 10-year period, you're not concerned. Now, why do I say you might not begin to liquidate until you're 70? That's because you probably expect to live 15 years past the age of 70 anyway. And so you start taking your money out at the age of 70, but you only slowly liquidate because you know you'll be going to be holding a lot of it for another 15 years where you could also make a profit. So far, at least retroactively, Tom, I imagine you'd agree that this is not rocket science for the average person. A 401k retirement account, you put it in a stock index fund, it reinvests dividends, you don't look at it, and over the years, it earns money. It has its down years and has its up years, but the up years way compensate for the down years. Since 1871, or over any 30-year period, the stock market tends to return around about 9% per year, and after inflation, about 6%. So that's the key point about how easy it would have been to be able to invest for your retirement. It's not that challenging, would not have been that challenging. In my own case, I started at Dow Jones. I had 26 years there. I invested in a retirement fund and they garnished my salary, which was not that huge, never that huge. And I came away with $1 million in my 401k because I followed this route. not that difficult to do. But let me tell you two brief stories. I thought, well, just one. I was interviewing David Stockman, who he's been on your show, and he's a brilliant guy. And this was in October 2013, nearly 10 years ago. I interviewed him at a public forum called Junto, and he said in October 2013 that he had all his money in short-duration bonds, and he said that his preservation position was what he calls ABCD, anything Bernanke can't destroy. And of course, he was referring then to Ben Bernanke, who was head of the Federal Reserve, anything Bernanke can't destroy. And he was earning 0.4% on that money. That was in October 2013, when he warned that the performance of the stock market really is not reliable for the future. You really better get into those very low earning bonds of 0.4%. Well, of course, we can easily play that hindsight game. What if you had not taken Stockman's advice and invested instead in a stock index fund that reinvested dividends? You would have made, after inflation, 8.8% on your money, before inflation, 11.6%, had you ignored David Stockman. And here, Tom, I guess you want to step in, because now I guess the argument is, yes, it would have worked for 150 years, but what about the future? Is that...
Well, I mean, I realize that that sounds unreasonable, but a lot of people are going to be thinking that for instance, there were a lot of myths that people believed about real estate investing that came crashing down in 2008.
Oh, yes. Well, okay. Well, that's a good point. Well, as a matter of fact, when Jeremy Siegel and then I think you told me our friend Mark Skousen, Mark and I here, we have a special bond. Despite the fact that the last time I was on your show, I was definitely criticizing Mark's view of Adam Smith. But Mark and I have a special bond because we are both Austrians, and yet we both tend to dissent from what we both regard as a sort of stop-clock, doom-and-gloom view of the markets. No, real estate over the long run does earn something. It earns about 2% above inflation, but also it's very rocky. There's also the gold market. Gold has not done that well. Gold is basically barely back at its previous highs of about 10 years ago, and it's a wasting asset. You have to pay for the storage of gold. By the way, it's not as though real estate is impossible. You could indeed compile a long-term track record with real estate, but real estate doesn't do that much better than the rate of inflation. The stock market does 6.5 to 7 percentage points better. So it's far different in that sense. It's much superior. And so if you talk about long-term investment, I don't discount real estate altogether, but it does have its ups and downs. But you're mentioning that real estate is impossible to think in terms of, Tom. Is that what you're arguing?
No, my point was that everybody thought, just as you're saying with the stock market, everybody thought real estate just goes up and up.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And it's just one of the regularities of nature. Everybody, a quick message from Converso. I use the Converso app for privacy because I care about privacy. And because other messaging apps that tell you they're all about privacy look like the NSA next to Converso. With Converso, you've got end-to-end encryption, no storage of messages on the server, no user or metadata. And it's not just you and me. Huge percentages of Americans are saying they're concerned with their lack of privacy and data security. They're fed up with being tracked online. They distrust big tech. They think they influence politics, you think? And they think their phone's listening in on them. They believe their texts and calls are not secure. Converso solves it all. Full of great features like sensors off, completely deactivates your phone's camera and microphone for ultimate privacy. Self-destructing messages are automatically deleted from the recipient's device after a specified time. You can prevent screenshots from being taken. It's a fantastic app. As I say, I'm already using it, and I'm going to start using it with one of my super elite private groups. So be like Woods and go over to conversoapp.com and grab it. That's conversoapp.com.
Well, Tom, you remind me of something else. When the dot-com boom collapsed in 2000, 2001, 2002, and the NASDAQ, which was basically very tech-intensive, took years to recover, I would mention to people about the potential for Amazon or the potential for Google. And you know that people would tell me, but what are you talking about? Well, those internet stocks got wrecked in 2001. Similarly, of course, we had a situation in the 90s when people were polled. I guess, I don't know, I forget if it was people or average investor. They were polled and they said that when they were asked in a poll, what do you think the stock market can return year by year on average? The preferred number was 30%. 30%. There was insane, irrational exuberance, that phrase, that was taking hold of people in those years. So all of that is quite true. And indeed, the same kind of mania took place in the 90s with respect to real estate and into the aughts. Absolutely. And I like the way the economist Burton Malkiel puts it. He calls it the greater fool theory. I may be a fool to pay $20 for stock A, B, C, but there's a greater fool than I who pay $25, and he may be a fool to pay $25, but there's a greater fool than he who will pay $30. And of course, they are all fools, because ultimately, if you don't time it right, you will be the last fool. So you're absolutely right that this indeed is part of the reason why there are so many ups and downs in the stock market. And indeed, although that's something that you and I as Austrians want to emphasize, which is that if you had a stable money supply, the lunatic, irrational, exuberant, greater fools would have much more difficulty being unleashed, because there wouldn't be so much money floating around for them to do their mischief. On the other hand, there's no question that even in a regime of a stable money supply, you will get some bubble conditions. You'll get some irrational people, but very unlikely that you could have general bubbles as we had with the stock market. But that's the whole point. If you have a 5-year time horizon, certainly you could take a bath. I'm looking at a 5-year trend right here. Yeah, the 5-year trend. The 5-year trend was, in terms of inflation, was way down in the late 70s. It was down in the mid 80s. It was negative in the early aughts. It was negative in 2008. So it's had a lot of ups and downs. And that's the whole point, particularly when you talked about saving for retirement, Tom. The whole point was that when you are saving for retirement, you have perforce necessarily a long-term perspective. And that's why I said it's a 15-year phenomenon. You don't lose in the stock market if you have a 15-year time horizon. If you have a 5 and 10-year time horizon, you will. So that's the whole point.
Or you could.
Well, excuse me, you could. No, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, you could. You run a real risk of being disappointed. But as you ride it out for 15 years, and that's why I put a fine point in and said, well, start at age 30 in a stock index fund. You're going to start liquidating it when you're 70, but only when you sell. Well, you'll start major liquidation when you're 70, because you expect to live to 85, because you use the 15-year rule that within any 15 years, you're likely to be ahead of inflation. Now, let me make one other point, which is that as an Austrian, when I heard Stockman make that statement, or indeed when I read it back in 1979, the infamous Business Week cover story, The Death of Equities, I was intimidated too a little bit. The Death of Equities, and the subhead read, this was August 13th, 1979, how inflation is destroying the stock market. And indeed, at that point, inflation was destroying the stock market. But now let's get to the concepts involved. Why has the stock market, despite the fiat money ups and downs, despite the turmoil and the irrational exuberance that bids it up and that leads to collapse, why has it still beat inflation over any 15-year period? Because ultimately, in one cynical sense, you are sort of like betting. You're putting your money with the devil, or you're putting your money with the bad guys, because the corporations that you're investing in, they are the inflation. They will be hit on the cost side by inflation. Interesting digression. When you look at the history of price inflation and you look at the history of profit margins, the best performing decades were the 1950s and 1960s, the low inflation decades. The worst performing, well, among the worst performing decade was the 1970s and early 80s, the high inflation decades. Why? Because companies not only charge prices, they pay, they have costs. And those costs were hitting them hard and by surprise, eroding their profits. But eventually, over time, the margins right themselves and the companies adjust. And so in that sense, for that reason, you'll tend to beat inflation over any 15-year period, even though, again, my results show that you would have been deeply in the hole in the late 70s on a 5-year period. And again, once again in the hole in the early 80s on a 5-year period because of what price inflation was doing. And again, as well, on top of that, you're buying capitalism. You're buying at least a fair piece of capitalism. And unless capitalism is totally dead and gone, this won't be the death of equities. Equities are going to recover. But I want to introduce another nuance, which is maybe you're also buying capitalism. Maybe you're also buying my contraction for crony capitalism, capitalism. Because again, you're buying defense stocks. So you are making a pact with the devil when you buy some of these companies, especially since defense stocks are in the S&P 500. They're in the S&P 500, and they, of course, are feeding at the government trough. And maybe that bothers your conscience. That's a different matter. But the point is that in one sense, then, you are making a pact with the devil when you buy the stock market. So all those are the reasons that essentially you're investing in the profits under capitalism. And if you're not, let me go back to quoting Mises. As Mises said, what's the touchstone of a capitalist economy? A capitalist economy has a stock market. And as I like to point out to many people, the Scandinavian countries all have thriving stock markets. He said, that's where you find the essence of capitalism, that they have stock markets, that they're offering secondary markets for stock. And that could get into my explanation of what the real purpose of the stock market is. The stock market really is a place in which the initial investors in the company have a place to lay off their position in the secondary and tertiary markets that stock market offers. And so you are investing in capitalism and in capitalist profits, and they are likely to persist in this economy. Now, I still, however, will grant that if you want to argue, Tom, or anybody else wants to argue, that the future of the stock market is going to be the death of equities, then I'll acknowledge there's something to that. And I guess the best I can say is, as I usually argue, if people ask my advice, and you know, I'm not equipped to give investment advice, although I worked at Barron's, and people think, well, my God, you wrote for Barron's for 26 years. It's an investment wreck. You must know something. And on top of that, you're an Austrian economist, so you must have the real word. And my real word is, I would not be surprised if the next 30 years of the stock market won't be as good as the last 30 years. I mean, the last 30 years were quite good. The stock market earned 7%. But I would not be surprised if it doesn't do quite as well, but it still is likely to be the best place to put your money for retirement. Maybe it'll only do half as well, but it will still mean that your money will be intact and there will be some inflation-adjusted return over and above that. The final point I just want to end with, Tom, I guess, is that I'm struck by the fact that even though, by the way, as of March 31st, which is where I'm pinning this to, because I was looking at end-of-month data, as of March 31st of this year, the market was down by nearly 10% from the year before, down by nearly 10%. So we're looking at a sort of a half a bear market. And I, by the way, believe that most likely the market will be down again a year from now and maybe down by a considerable amount a year from now. But we are down by nearly 10%. And yet the 5-year performance of the stock market over the last, through March 31st, was 7.3% inflation adjusted. That if all of the bad stuff has been happening that David Stockman talked about, and yet over the last 5 years, through this period of the stock market being down, we're still up by 7.3%. Again, that's a 60-month basis over 5 years. So again, it gets back to the Mark Twain cliche, you know, when they announced his death and he reissued a statement saying rumors of my death are much exaggerated. It does appear that rumors of the death of equities are much exaggerated as well. So that's basically my spiel, Tom. And what's your contribution? What do you think?
All right. Well, as we kind of wrap up, let me throw a curveball at you because this is not really related to our initial conversation, but it's one that I know some people are thinking about.
Okay.
Which is, let's say, I think a lot of people might be able to say the following. I'm really a stickler in terms of the moral requirements for me to invest money. And I bet a lot of these indexes have a lot of evil corporations in them that do evil things, that you know, the military industrial complex, or they're woke or whatever it is. And I don't want my money to be part of that. So I'm left out in the cold while Gene is raking in the dough.
Making a pact with the devil. Well, I said that, Tom. I pointed that out. Indeed, to some degree, stock market does well because you're making a pact with the devil. So you're saying that what if you don't want to make a pact with the devil?
Yeah, then you're going to wish you had hard money.
Okay, Tom. Okay, well, then, first of all, I'm glad you raised that broader point because, of course, I want to emphasize that I indeed do want to end the Fed. And I'm going to be arguing that, just to get back to my pitch, on May 22nd about the ways in which the Federal Reserve completely abrogates democracy, apart from the ways in which the Federal Reserve causes business cycles and causes instability in the stock market. And on top of that, I do believe that the stock market would perform much better. Although, by the way, Tom, to come to think of it, I would still say that the idea that, of course, we want to abolish fiat money. Clearly, we want to abolish fiat money. But you and I would not, and that's why I cited Ludwig Mises' writing in 1912, that you basically just put your money in a mattress. It will appreciate, but you can turbocharge those gains. The whole point is that if your money is going to appreciate by 2% a year, because money naturally appreciates from keeping it in a mattress, if you put it in the market, then it will appreciate by that 2% plus 6%, because you'll eventually sell the stocks when you need them, when you need the money, which in this case would be in your retirement, and your money will appreciate by that 2% a year when you liquidate. On top of that, you will invest in the stock market. So Mises just expected that the vast majority of us would take advantage of financial instruments. There would be, on top of that, speculation in commodities, speculation in real estate. Real estate actually is an interesting case about where it would go under stable money. That's an interesting case. I think it would appreciate, but that's a complicated issue to get into. But obviously, the vast majority of us would be, you know, my mother lived in Century Village. And she had been a nurse. And in Century Village, it was retired school teachers and bureaucrats and nurses, people of limited means, but they all had a few hundred thousand saved up because they were frugal during their lifetime. And the brokers were plowing that field. My mother had a broker and she watched Wall Street Week, even though, by the way, Mommy was a commie, but of course she was filled with contradictions. Why do I make that point? Only because people will inevitably take an interest in financial instruments because there'll be plenty of capitalist brokers trying to get them to take that interest. But again, I guess I didn't answer your question about making a pact with the devil in the stock market. I think, Tom, that if you and I were to compile a list of companies that are at least reasonably this side of decent from the standpoint of a libertarian, they'd probably do pretty well also. I think in terms of Whole Foods, which, you know, run by a libertarian, John Mackey, probably if we were to carve out 200 companies that behave reasonably well, that don't, I guess they're all impure a little bit. Is it your point, Tom, that empirically it would be almost impossible to find companies that aren't essentially corrupted by crony capitalism?
I'm not making that. I'm saying that I know there are people out there who are concerned that there wouldn't be a stock index.
Oh, wow.
Where there wouldn't be, I'm sure you could bundle together some individual stocks.
Well, the point is that if I were to bundle together like 100 stocks that are reasonable cap weighted and say that while maybe they've occasionally taken advantage of government's eminent domain, as in the case of Walmart, that on balance, they've done a lot of good in the world, as Walmart, I think, has, or Whole Foods has. I believe that I would be able to compile a reasonable list of stock that, and, you know, let's all throw the first stone when it comes to being immoral, that they're not totally above board, but they behave decently. They're not at the extreme. They're not defense stocks, military stocks. I believe that if I compiled that list and showed its track record, that it could do about as well as the rest of the market could. But again, I'm speculating, Tom. It's an interesting assignment because usually, by the way, of course, they have the woke list. And I did come across research recently showing that companies that are very woke in terms of their attitudes do not do as well as companies that aren't. That the companies that just focus on the bottom line, as Milton Friedman wanted them to. By the way, I should digress because I love Milton Friedman's point. People always ask, well, why did Milton Friedman think that these companies should not be meddling in social affairs or thinking that they have to be run by philosopher kings? Milton Friedman said, look, you run a company that manufactures, that sells widgets, that manufactures widgets. The only reason why you have the job is because you know how to manufacture and sell widgets. Nobody appointed you as the rabbi or priest who knows anything special about social issues. So just pay your people their salaries and pay your dividends and let individuals decide how they want to orient their money for good or for evil. And I thought that was a very good-hearted point on the part of Milton Friedman. He just told these corporate CEOs, you shouldn't be doing this because this is above your pay grade. I thought that was a good point. So I want to fit that in. But the point is that if we compiled a special libertarian list of companies, I think that they would do decently in the market, most likely. But in any case, Tom, I grant that yours is an interesting challenge about investing in the stock market without making a pact with the devil.
All right, we'll leave it there. And I'll recommend that people, of course, check the Soho Forum website, because even if you don't live in Manhattan, you can still check out the debates. And then, of course, you have a podcast where people can listen to them.
Plus, Tom, it's May 22nd, Monday. Tom Woods comes to New York frequently to catch a show. Come that weekend before May 21st, 20th, to see the play that goes wrong at the New World Stage. And then Monday night, catch the Soho Forum. We have a lot of tourists who come in and see our debates. And you're giving me the wonderful opportunity, Tom, to announce it in advance so that people can make their travel plans for Monday, March 22nd.
And by the way, just so people don't confuse things, through July of 2023, there is also Peter Pan Goes Wrong. That's a different play. We're talking about the play that goes wrong. It's made by the same company. And the Peter Pan Goes Wrong show is actually playing on Broadway proper, whereas the play that goes wrong has been off Broadway for a few years.
Well, but on 50th Street.
50th Street around 8th Avenue.
Not very far away.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Not very far away from the Times Square area, so it's basically
Yeah, it's easy to get to, but the Peter Pan Goes Wrong production has the original cast from all these plays, and it's on Broadway. I still think it's not as funny as the play that goes wrong. People were laughing hysterically at it. And I was just thinking to myself, if you think this is funny, you need to go see the play that goes wrong. That's the funny one.
Tom, exactly, Tom. Thank you for augmenting my suggestion. Come in that Friday evening on May 19th and catch a Saturday matinee of the play that goes wrong and a Saturday evening performance or a Sunday matinee of the Peter Pan Goes Wrong. So that would be a double feature of wrong plays to follow in the aesthetic footsteps of the great Tom Woods. And then Monday night, catch the Soho Forum debate.
All right. So with that, thesohoforum.org is the website. And our good friend Gene Epstein, thanks so much for today.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.